Hello and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara Papinski. On today's show, I'm excited to share an interview with an author whose new biography is sure to delight fans of Anne of Green Gables. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
So I'm so pleased to welcome Liz Rosenberg to the podcast. Liz is a poet, novelist, professor, and writer of many acclaimed books for children. Her latest book is called House of Dreams, The Life of L.M. Montgomery, and it is a biography of the author of Anne of Green Gables, written for young adults. Liz, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
So I was so excited when I first heard about your book. I'm a huge Anne of Green Gables fan, as I know many are. And your book does such a wonderful job of sort of showing the complexity of the author's life, and it just made me admire her even more as an author. I loved it so much. So I was curious what inspired you to write the book, and if you were also a fan of Anne of Green Gables before you started?
Very much so. Unlike you, I did not actually name my daughter Anne. I have loved that book since I was a girl. I still have the copy that my mom gave me probably around age 10, and it's got a green cloth binding, so I can picture it in my mind. And I'm looking at it. Actually, it's kind of moss green. I can see that now. And I'm sure, even as a child, I had read it quite a few times, but by now I think I can honestly say I've read it at least a dozen times, and that's probably an underestimate.
was it your love for the book that made you want to write the biography, or was there something else that spurred that?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I'm sure that the fact that I loved this writer had an enormous amount to do with it. I think many writers write out of love for one thing or another. But I can remember the moment when I sort of started kind of on this journey toward writing a biography of L.M. Montgomery. My husband and I were driving in the car, and we were listening to a books on tape version of Anne of Green Gables by a particularly wonderful reader, and unfortunately I can't remember her name right now. But we used to listen to that quite often. So, for anybody listening who doesn't know the book very well or doesn't remember it, one of the main characters is this older woman named Marilla, and she is quite sharp and at times almost harsh, but she softens a great deal during the course of the book. And I remember I turned to my husband and I said, you know, I'll bet there's a story behind the real Marilla. It was like a detective. I was looking for the clues of who the real Marilla might be and what she was like. And I have to say, what I discovered was not what I had expected to find. And that's always a pleasure for any writer as well. You know, if you don't have a sense of surprise and discovery, you don't have the same passion for the thing you're writing about. So I was expecting to find maybe there had been an abusive mother or relative, and that's not what I found at all. I found a woman who was Ellen Montgomery's grandmother, and she didn't feel close to her grandmother at all, but she wasn't very much like Marilla, except if you ever get to see a picture of Lucy McNeil, and that was her grandmother's name, she looked exactly the way you would picture Marilla to look. I mean, exactly.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's such a rich subject for sort of exactly that reason, that whole sort of mixing between her real life and sort of the fictional characters in her stories. And I'm curious what your process was like as you were researching. I mean, I'm assuming you probably reread some of the books, but how else did you sort of dive into her life and do the research?
Well, I was lucky because a woman named Mary Rubio, who is truly a Montgomery scholar, had written really the definitive biography of Montgomery for grown-ups, and it's quite a thick and thorough book. She agreed to correspond with me. She met with me. I went to her house. We had lots of interesting conversations about Montgomery. So that was enormously helpful. I also got permission from Montgomery's family to be able to look through all her papers and use quotes from all her books and use a whole bunch of photographs, which unfortunately never made it into the book. So there's a wonderful library up in, now I'm forgetting the name of the, University of Guelph, that's what it is. I'm probably butchering the name Guelph. And they have not only her papers, but things like her embroidery handiwork, her wedding dress. I mean, just amazing stuff that makes you feel like you're suddenly in the presence of the person.
Is that on Prince Edward Island?
No, interestingly enough, no. It's part of, it's near Toronto. It's what Montgomery herself called smug, opulent Ontario. She never was entirely convinced that any place in the world was as beautiful as Prince Edward Island. So interestingly enough, no. There are some historical places on Prince Edward Island, of course, and people come to visit it.
Right. I was going to say I've sort of done the Anne of Green Gables pilgrimage to PEI, but that wasn't something I'd seen, so I'll have to sort of add that to the list of Anne's sites to check out.
Oh, for sure. It's a treasure trove. I mean, they have all of her original journals in her handwriting, so it's an almost overwhelming feeling if you're really a devoted fan of her work, as you and I clearly are.
Right. Well, it's amazing that she left such a sort of rich, firsthand set of material with all of her journals and letters. I'm guessing as a biographer that sort of the dream to have all of that.
It really is. Yeah, it truly is. And we know that she destroyed a lot of stuff. She destroyed her earliest notebooks or earliest stories, which she herself regretted later in life.
Right.
She sort of described them to us, but she cut out from her journal her impressions of the first time she met her husband.
Interesting.
You know, so there are gaps, but yeah, it's overwhelming how much she really recorded about her life between the journals and then copious letters. We really do have a lot to go on. We also have to read between the lines because she didn't always tell the truth, not in her letters and not even in her journals. She sometimes lied to herself.
That's a really interesting. You go into that a little bit in the book, and it's interesting sort of that discrepancy between real life and what she recorded sometimes.
Yeah.
I guess, so going back to the beginning of the book and her early life, I knew she had experienced a lot of loss of a child, but just the amount you share in the book and just how much tragedy she experienced was so striking. And can you talk a little bit about the circumstances that led her to be taken in by those McNeil grandparents?
Sure. Well, her mother died when she was, I think, slightly less than two. Her name was Clara McNeil. And there's very little known about her. She was hardly ever spoken of within the family after she died. We know she died of tuberculosis, and she had married Hugh John Montgomery, who was sort of a dashing military man. And I think the two of them were kind of like babies. You know, they were in love, but they weren't very good at practical things. So the two sets of parents tried to set them up with a little country store, but then she got ill and she died. And so here's Hugh John left alone with this toddler and the need to make a living. So for a time, you know, Maud, as she was known, Maud without an E, by the way, Maud would kind of shuttle back and forth a bit between her maternal grandparents, the McNeils, and her father, Hugh John. But he kept going further and further afield until finally he went all the way to Western Canada, basically abandoning her when she was something like 7 years old, and leaving her in the care of these kind of aging grandparents who had just married off most of their children and were about to marry off their last daughter at home, Emily. And they weren't expecting this, you know. So Alexander McNeil, her grandfather, was especially not happy about it.
Right.
And it was really Lucy McNeil, the grandmother who I said looked so much like Marilla, who kind of stepped into that gap, stepped into that absence and really took on the practical aspects of raising this very unorthodox, unusual girl. Mm-hmm. And that is true. And that way she really does resemble Anne. And if you see a photograph of her as a young girl, and again, I so wish that at least some of these photographs could have been included, but we have this gorgeous illustrator, so that more than makes up for it, I suppose. But you look at her face with these huge eyes and her clasped hands, and she just looks like the Anne that you picture.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing to read about. I think I had assumed that she had immediately been sent to her grandparents after her mother died and didn't really know her father, but you write about how that really wasn't the case and how much she loved her father and was...
Oh, she adored him. Yes,
yeah,
adored
how
him.
It just made it all the more heartbreaking to then see him move so far away, and essentially she's abandoned yet again. And then when you're writing about her relationship with her grandparents, you shared this one anecdote that just stuck with me and broke my heart a little bit. You wrote, "Maud yearned for open expressions of tenderness as when a family friend looking in on her one night murmured, 'Dear little child,' a phrase Maud remembered and cherished all her life. Displays of overt affection like these were rare." She's just like searching for these little crumbs of affection. And I just thought that was so heartbreaking. Could you sort of talk about how, you know, in some ways she was well off with the grandparents, but in other ways, it's really not so much.
Yeah, in other ways, dark. And this is, I think, one of the reasons she adored her dad, is he was very openly affectionate. He was, he called her by pet names, and he made his love for her very, very clear. And she felt connected to him all her life, even when they were, you know, many hundreds of miles apart. But her grandparents were sort of, you know, older stock, so to speak. And they were from the sort of strict Scottish Presbyterian school. And I think they played it very close to the vest. Her grandfather was kind of a thorny character. So he would actually be very sarcastic and cutting, at least to your face. And then she would hear from her cousins that he actually praised her behind her back. And her grandmother really did provide for her materially. You know, Maud was one of the only girls in school who had a fine pair of boots to wear in the winter and who came home to eat a good meal in the middle of the day. But she felt emotionally kind of starved. There was no sympathy, she said, between her and her grandparents. And so she never dedicated a single book to them.
That was so striking. And her husband, too, she never dedicated a book to, I think you wrote.
Well, she never thought he read her work. And the little that he did read, she had a feeling he didn't like too much. So, maybe there's that tendency that people have to sort of marry an image of the parental unit. And unfortunately, she was drawn toward the Hugh Johns, right? She was drawn toward the men that were openly affectionate and fun-loving. But in the end, she, I suppose, felt more at home with someone a little bit more like her grandparents.
Right. So interesting. Well, you've sort of touched on how Marilla has some roots in her grandmother. And could you talk about some of the other ways she drew on her childhood for Anne of Green Gables?
Sure. Well, there are so many ways. It's kind of like going through, right now I'm writing the biography of Louisa May Alcott. And
one of my other favorites.
Yeah, they usually do kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many parallels, you know, between Louisa's life and Jo March. And it's the same kind of thing with Maud. You know, she once said to a friend, you know, we write the story that is in us to write, and the rest is in the laps of the gods. And I think that she really wrote the story that only she could write. So there were a lot of aspects that were the same. She really did name inanimate objects around her, and I'm using that word loosely because, like her, I kind of agree that trees are almost like people. But she would name the trees in her grandparents' yard. She would name the, pot of geraniums. She really had the friends in the little cupboard mirror. She actually had two friends, but she only put one into Anne of Green Gables. And then I love this. You know, we all remember the puffed sleeves, right? How much Anne longed for a dress with puffed sleeves. And somewhere in, I think it might be in her memoir, she writes about how when she was a child, her grandmother sent her to school wearing this sort of apron with some kind of odd sleeve to it, and how embarrassed she felt about that. So it's funny how she kind of like inverts that story. There are just so many examples of that. For instance, at a certain point when she was a young woman, she lived with a minister's wife, a minister who was often away. And it was actually the minister's wife who once stirred the wrong ingredient into a cake, and they served it. And in the book, of course, it's Anne herself. She has almost all the mishaps anyway. So it's tiny little things like that. You discover them, and there's this feeling of having discovered a piece of gold, you know?
Yeah, and it's so interesting you bring up the parallels to Louisa May Alcott. That's one of the questions I had for you, and part of it is I've had that author on my mind. I just read and interviewed the author of Meg Jo Beth Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters, and sort of watching Louisa May Alcott's writing life made me wonder if we know whether Maud read Little Women or drew on the inspiration of Louisa May Alcott at all, because they seem to have so many similarities in their journeys as authors.
Right, they do. Well, they certainly are both among the first writers really ever to have a female heroine who's not perfect. Mm-hmm. And who's a bit of an outsider. That's true for both of them. But no, as far as I know, Maud never read Louisa May Alcott. And in fact, I would say that I can't think of a single female author that she referred to on any regular kind of basis. So I may be wrong in that I think she did reference Charlotte Bronte at one point. I think she read Charlotte Bronte. And I know she was compared to Charlotte Bronte in a newspaper article in Boston. But I think that comparison was made because they both were seen as sort of girlish, surprisingly girlish and pretty, and as country bumpkins from a far province. Yeah, most of the people she admired were, people like Washington Irving and Scott and the classics, really. And she would have had exposure, of course, to very few women because she grew up in a home which was largely filled with religious tracts. You know, there were only a handful of novels, and I guarantee you, none of them were written by women.
Well, it just makes it even more inspiring. I mean, the amount of obstacles she overcame as a person, but also as a writer, are just incredible. And it just seems like from such a young age, she had that strong conviction that she wanted to be a writer.
She really did. She said, I can't remember a time when I didn't want to be scribbling. You know, she just seemed to understand at a very early age that this was kind of her gift and this would be her salvation. And and you're right. It's like watching some kind of an Olympic hurdler. You know, you just watch her hurdle over one obstacle after another with that amazing sense of humor and incredible bright optimism. And when you think of all the things that were exerting a force of gravity against her, it makes it even more remarkable to watch her, making those jumps.
It really does, and makes you appreciate the finished books and the success she did achieve that much more. I mean, it struck me how at one point she's talking about brainstorming plot points for her stories while she's doing housework. I think when she and her grandmother are really struggling in the house a little bit later on.
Right, after the grandfather dies, yep.
Yeah, and then later, you write about how she she continues to publish a book a year, even sort of in the midst of early motherhood and duties as a minister's wife. It's just amazing her drive as a writer through all the stages of her life.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes she writes about how she would have, you know, an hour in the morning to do, I forget what it was, maybe reread what she had written the day before, and an hour to write something new. And then, you know, the rest of the time was spent on, you know, housekeeping and child rearing and the endless round of calls that you live through if you're a minister's wife. And, you know, an hour a day to write, really? I mean, given how many books she produced, I guess you have to be very productive. But we know that she did things like she walked around and she would stuff little pieces of paper into her apron pocket. Whenever an idea came to her, she would scribble it down and put it in her pocket. I love the story about how she would, you know, when guests were over or maybe her children's friends, they would hear her suddenly burst out laughing, apparently for no reason. And she'd say things like, "That's what I'll do. That's exactly what I'll do."
Yeah, it just seems like such an interesting combination of being both such a gifted writer, but also so hardworking and relentless. And, you know, when she does really, you know, she publishes little pieces all along, you write about that. But when she does really hit her stride and become so well-known and in Anne of Green Gables and, you know, really achieve that success, what do you attribute that to? What's your take on why that has really resonated with readers for, I mean, it's more than 100 years now and people just still love it so much.
Right, they do. Well, it's a great book. By any measure, I think it's a great book. It's beautifully written. Her words, her rhythms are so lyrical. If you look at that opening to Anne of Green Gables, it's one paragraph. It's one paragraph, and it's about a brook running by a nosy neighbor's house, and it sounds like the water of a brook rushing past you. And I think, really, she wrote out of her deepest self, and she was writing truths that I think until then had not really been said, you know, what it feels like to be an outcast, and that maybe there could be value in a female who didn't fit the sort of model of the, you know, the sickly, religious, spiritual kind of, or perfect housewife, the angel of the household is what they, you know, they called it in Victorian times. And she's more like the devil of the household, right? She's constantly getting into trouble. And I think that she and Joe March, right, from Little Women, they both kind of kick things wide open. And we're still feeling some of that. You know, there's still things that are said and done to little girls that would make them think that, you know, it really is better to be quiet and obedient and docile. So I think those stories still really reverberate, you know?
I agree. And I think, you know, then and now, I think we still need those stories that we want to escape into. And you know, I think there's a reason why people continue to make those pilgrimages to Prince Edward Island, because she does just create this, you know, heartwarming, lovely place. You wrote somewhere that Anne of Green Gables is sort of a literary antidepressant, I think is what you said. And I think we need that. And I think hearing her backstory just makes you appreciate her ability to create that even more.
Absolutely. I mean, she herself was pretty clearly manic depressive. And she went through some very severe periods of depression. So I think she understood the need for light and for laughter. And she said, you know, I want to be an emissary of light. I don't want to drag other people down. She had a compelling desire both to kind of self-comfort by creating these fictional worlds. And she lived in them from the time I think she was very young. And also to kind of help others that way. I don't know that it was always a conscious decision, but sometimes it was. And I think she knew, I can either, you know, burrow into the darkness or I can aim toward the light. And she chose the latter.
Well, I think it's really powerful that now young people, I mean, I'm imagining this would be a great book to hand to a middle schooler who loves Anna Green Gables or her other books. And I think it's really powerful for young people and even adults to see the struggles she faced and the way she overcame them. I did want to ask you one other thing about your book. I thought the illustrations were such a beautiful compliment to the biography, and I was curious about the process behind them with the illustrator, Julie Morstad, if you sort of shared the mood you wanted. Or...
Well, you know, people are always surprised to hear that there's very little direct communication between authors and their illustrators. Mm-hmm. So what happened in this case was that my editor presented me with, I think, three different illustrators and their work. And to me, Julie Morstad was just a slam dunk. As soon as I saw her work, I thought, man, that's really who I would love to see illustrating this book. She had done a previous biography of a dancer, I believe, and she just had a kind of a delicacy in the line, and you know, she's able to capture so much and sort of put these little tiny things into the pictures. I still am discovering things every time I look at one of her illustrations.
They're just gorgeous. But
they are. They're beautiful. They're
and so
beautiful.
Thoughtful. They just really work so well with the tech.
I'm glad to hear you. Yeah.
I think they will also really appeal to the young readers picking up the book. So that's really wonderful as well. And so you mentioned that your next project is a Louisa May Alcott biography. Is there a timeline yet for that? When can we look for that?
Well, let's see now. The Montgomery biography was a very long time, not so much in the making, actually. I was able to write it fairly quickly. I think something like 6 months, actually, which is, to me, incredibly fast.
Yeah.
But then there needed to be revisions. You know, it was a pretty clunky first draft, and I have a wonderful editor named Elizabeth Bicknell who really kind of walked me through the necessary revisions. So that probably took another year. And then it was, I think, 3 years before the book was actually published. I believe that's right, because I finished it, I think, in 2014, and, you know, here we are now in 2018.
Right.
So sometimes it can take a very long time. I really don't know what will happen with the Alcott biography. I suspect I will again present Liz Bicknell with a less than perfect first draft and that she will help me to be better, but I don't really know. It's kind of funny, too, because I seem to have a genius for just missing things. You know, like the biography of Montgomery came out, what, maybe a year after they had done that new Anne of Green Gables series on TV.
Oh, right. But they're coming out with a new season, I think. So
are they really? Yeah?
Yeah, although I must say that I've been nervous to watch because at one point I read that it's supposed to be a darker portrayal,
yes.
And I don't really want a darker portrayal, so I
no,
haven't
neither do I.
Watched
yep.
yet. But
I gotcha.
It has had
And then the same thing with Alcott, you know. I think this year is the something anniversary of the publication of the book.
The 150th, yeah.
There you go. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of celebrations and writings and, you know, again, there was recently a TV series, a new version of Little Women. They keep trying to get it right. But what I'm actually really excited about is the new movie where they put it in a completely contemporary setting. And I have thought for a long time that that's exactly what needed to be done.
You I do think that's really, going to be really interesting.
Yeah. And it looks great to me. I mean, I've seen a few coming attractions. I honestly think they are capturing the spirit of the book, at least from the glimpses I've seen. You can't always tell from coming attractions. Sometimes those are the only great 3 minutes in a movie, but I feel very hopeful. It looks wonderful to me.
Yeah, there's that one, and then I've heard there's a really interesting cast being pulled together for another version directed, I guess, by Greta Gerwig, who did Lady Bird. So I think...
Ooh.
I think there's some really interesting versions coming up. But in a way, it'll be good because it gives young readers who are hopefully rediscovering the book a chance to read Little Women and more of her books, and then they can follow it up with your biography as well. And
I think what a biographer wants is to drive the reader back to the source of the biography. In other words, mm-hmm. I was very conscious of feeling like, okay, I want to try my best to create a new audience for Montgomery because she really deserves it. And I feel the same way about Alcott.
Yep. Well, you mentioned in terms of your inspiration for the book, listening to Anne of Green Gables, and I think I would recommend that as well to draw in more readers, because I've listened to the audiobook of actually the whole series, and I think that could really draw young people in as well, especially if they're having some trouble getting into it.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, I'm hoping, I mean, I'm always recommending them, so I'm hoping more and more kids love Anne of Green Gables and Little Women. So that's great that you're promoting them.
They're listening to the same reader. I know it's a woman. I know, to be honest, that she's the only narrator that I really love. And I remember that, you know, my husband had never read Anne of Green Gables because, of course, it's been viewed as a quote-unquote girl's book.
Yeah.
Right? Along with Little Women,
mm-hmm.
which he also ended up loving. But it was really Matthew who drew him in, and that voice when she would say, "Well, now," which is what he says before he says anything.
Yeah,
remember
I'll have
that?
To look back. I listened, I'm remembering now, I listened to some LibriVox recordings. I think they're available like in the podcast app,
yes.
But I don't remember which one, but I just thought it was such nice company, again, in the car or doing chores or something. It was just so comforting to listen to and so well done.
Absolutely. And it brings it to life because, you know, she really had an ear for how people talked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the first time I saw a Shakespeare play, and it was Twelfth Night and I was a kid, that's the first time I had any clue about why Shakespeare was a great writer.
That's such a good comparison. I think, yeah, even just the rhythm of the text and just really pulling you in as a reader and a listener.
It comes alive, right?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm really excited for people to read the biography and to continue to discover her work. So thank you for writing it, and thank you for speaking with me. It's been so wonderful to get to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I've loved it too. Well, and it sounds like you've got some really great things that you're working on.
I'm excited. It's just so fun to get to talk about books even more. So I'm having fun
sure.
with it.
Now, I had a sense just from something you said a few minutes ago. Do you also write fiction yourself or poetry maybe?
I don't know. It's something I've always wanted to try. So I'm going to have to. Going to have to do that at
Make
some point.
That easy these days. Yeah, I think
yes.
so. I think,
yeah.
I think for most of us who write, the very first thing that happens is that we love books.
Right, and there is nothing I love more. So I think, you know, it's funny reading your biography and then that new Little Women book I was talking about, you know, I sort of took for granted as a kid that everyone wanted to grow up to be an author, I think just from loving these books so much, and then have to step back and think, oh, I guess that wasn't everyone's dream. I just sort of took that for granted, but
you know, definitely. I know, it took me a long time to realize that too, and then I finally put it together, and you know what it's kind of about? Because so many children's books are about somebody who writes or somebody who reads, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
we see this again and again. It's not true of somebody like Pippi Longstocking, but it's certainly true of Jo and Little Women. It's certainly true of Anne. It's true of, you know, just so many characters. And, of course, the reason is because the author is an author.
Right, right. And they're able to draw on that whole experience and,
yeah,
and mentality. Yep, and then reread that and take it all in and internalize it. So, yeah, it's so interesting. But, yeah, definitely leaves its mark. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks again. And again, I can't wait to read the new biography whenever that's done. I'll really look forward to that.
Aw, thank you very much. That's very heartening to hear.
Liz Rosenberg's new book is called House of Dreams, The Life of L.M. Montgomery, and you'll find a link to that in the show notes. For more book recommendations and ideas for creating a culture of reading in your home, you can follow my blog, abookishhome.com, or look for me on Twitter, @abookishhome. And if you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. It would also be so helpful if you could rate and review us in iTunes. That really helps people find the show or tell a friend. Happy reading!